In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Unprecedented security surrounds the U.S. Capitol for tomorrow's inauguration. Coming up in just a few minutes, evaluating the potential threats with a former military intelligence analyst, now political scientist. That would be Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa. But first, let's get an update on what lawmakers are doing at the Iowa State House. Katarina Sestarek joins me, IPR's state government reporter. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
While we're on the topic of security, tell us, how has it been around the Iowa State House this weekend? Any protests, gatherings, anything the like of that ahead of the inauguration?
No, the Iowa Capitol has had some increased security over the past few days and will continue probably through this week at least. Because, you know, the FBI did warn of the potential for armed protests at all 50 state capitals. But there were no state-specific threats for Iowa. At least that's what the Department of Public Safety had said last week. And then over this weekend, there were not any protests at the Iowa Capitol. So I think some of the elevated threat concerns are supposed to go through the inauguration, which is scheduled for tomorrow. So DPS will keep watching the Capitol closely.
Okay, let's talk about work inside the State House. This morning, I understand Republicans advancing some bills having to do with constitutional amendments.
Right. So Republican lawmakers in the House have advanced out of a subcommittee a constitutional amendment that would change the Iowa Constitution to say it doesn't protect abortion rights. Right now, there is not language that's in the Constitution that says it does protect abortion rights, but of course, the Iowa Supreme Court a couple of years ago ruled that the Constitution does protect abortion rights as a fundamental right, which essentially undermined any further attempts by Republican lawmakers to pass restrictions on abortion. And this is something that Republican lawmakers have been, they're essentially trying to overturn that court case by passing a constitutional amendment. And so this is the third year in a row that Republicans are trying to advance this legislation. Ultimately, last year, the Senate passed it, but the House did not. So if the House and Senate were both to pass it this year, then it would have to pass again 2 years from now, and then it would go to a vote of the people. And of course, those who support abortion rights say that this is something that could essentially just continue to erode abortion rights in Iowa and make it really difficult for women to access abortion here.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You were going to continue on with their action about to protect gun rights as well.
Correct. So a separate House subcommittee also advanced a constitutional amendment that would add gun rights language to the Iowa Constitution. And it's language that would actually go further than the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So this is something that is further along in the constitutional amendment process. If the House and Senate pass it this year, it'll go on the ballot next year for a vote of the people. And this is something that, you know, supporters say is necessary to protect against future gun restrictions. But opponents say that it could be used to essentially dismantle Iowa's current gun laws.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Well, Iowa's last execution was in 1963, I understand, as is par for every year, it seems. There were conversations about returning capital punishment to Iowa.
Right. So the proposal to bring back the death penalty has come up in the legislature on the Republican side the past few years, and it has advanced in the past, but never all the way to the governor's desk for a signature. It's not clear if this has more support this year than it has in the past or not, and it's a measure that would apply specifically to someone who's convicted of kidnapping, sexually assaulting, and murdering a child. That's the offense that the death penalty would apply to if this passes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, before we go, I understand an alert, some attention given to a COVID-19 case associated with the Iowa House. Tell us about that.
Yes, on Friday, the chief clerk of the Iowa House notified lawmakers that they said someone associated with the Iowa House of Representatives tested positive for COVID-19. Someone who had been in the building in the first half of last week, when there was the condition of the state address and the opening of the legislature. It said that the person had been wearing a face covering the whole time, but we don't have much more information than that. Masks aren't required at the Capitol. Democrats have been, and the Iowa Public Health Association, have been raising concerns about the COVID-19 protocols there. And also, people who test positive for COVID at the Capitol aren't required to disclose that. And this information was not voluntarily released to the public. Reporters obtained the information. So it's not clear the extent to which the public will really find out about further COVID cases at the Capitol.
Okay, Katarina, I'll just throw in there some reading from the New York Times tells me also a Minnesota state senator died from COVID-19 after attending a celebratory dinner with other Republicans following Election Day. According to the New York Times, masks were offered to guests on arrival, but there were it's little mask wearing over the hours of dining and drinking. And according to that article in the New York Times today, at least 7 state lawmakers are believed to have died from COVID-19, all but one being Republicans. Okay. Katarina Sestarek, thank you very much, IPR's state government reporter.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, of course, Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th president, U.S. President Kamala Harris, as the first female vice president in our country's history. Listen to IPR for special coverage of the inauguration tomorrow, starting at 10 a.m. It's expected to go through the noon hour as well. After the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of President Trump and an insurrection that resulted in 5 deaths, sent lawmakers scurrying into hiding, the U.S. government has imposed unprecedented security surrounding the Capitol for the inauguration, security that includes non-scalable fences rimmed with razor wire and a large security zone that the public is barred from. Let's get a perspective on the security in place and the intelligence on potential disruption from Evan Renfro. He's assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. We're turning to him also because of his background as a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst and senior civilian intelligence analyst. Evan, thank you for joining us for a few minutes.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Good to be with you.
With your background, what are your top concerns on the eve of Inauguration Day?
Well, it's vitally important that this country continue its great tradition, which is very rare in the world, of having a peaceful transfer of power. So the security will be unprecedented at the inauguration because of the groups that have been riled up and fed lies by President Trump and other senior Republican leaders. All the full weight of the national security apparatus, excluding the military intelligence. I have to tell you, pursuant to Executive Order 12333, if I was back in my military intelligence days, it's still illegal for U.S. military to target U.S. citizens. But barring that, every police department you can think of, and certainly every federal law enforcement and intelligence agency, will be primed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We are in the depths of 3 major crises, the health crisis, national economic crisis, and this social crisis. What are your thoughts on the momentous challenges facing the Biden administration?
I'm glad it's not me. He has to worry not. And so far, he's really not mentioned all of this violent rhetoric and actions from certain groups in the within the Republican Party. He's far more concerned, at least outwardly, concerned with getting his cabinet officials confirmed and getting on with his business, making immediate policy shifts for the environment, for bureaucracies to get back on track, for people with experience getting back in the saddle and running the federal government. So he's got his hands full, and then not to mention you have all this going on, but you have to worry about your external actors. I think at the beginning of the show, NPR was just talking about Iran is not going away, Russia is not going away, China is not going away, COVID is not going away. I mean, the list is challenging and daunting.
Yeah, right. And Biden ran his campaign on a message of unity. How can that happen, do you imagine, Evan, when, according to polls, most Republicans believe, without evidence, that Donald Trump definitely or probably won the election? In other words, we have tens of millions of Americans who don't think he is the legitimate president.
Well, I'm afraid you just answered your own question. You can't have unity as long as you have that. A significant portion of the Republican Party, like you just said, is simply not. In order to have a functioning Democratic Republic, society has to be on the same page of reality. And what's happened, it's most healthy to have two normal political parties, one that's a little bit more conservative and one that's a little bit more progressive. That's how democracy always is best run, has the greatest longevity, and so forth. But when one of the major political parties has this sort of breakdown, this is when history shows us that you just can't wish for unity to manifest itself.
Right.
So there's going to have to be a realignment within the party, or there's going to have to be a split. I'm not sure what, but you have the Mike McConnell wing of the Republican Party. You have then a sort of a Ben Sasse wing, and then you have the Ted Cruz Hawley wing, and these have not much in common.
Mm-hmm. I wondered, we had talked prior to the election about all the controversy, the talk of civil war. Nearly 2 weeks ago, pro-Trump extremists breached the Capitol, attacked police, called for the vice president's execution, some of them. And in the days since, I've heard some national security experts see an even bigger danger, a domestic insurgency. You are a former military intelligence analyst, and I see on your resume you have taught a course on, among other things, terrorism and insurgency. How concerned are you that this is a turning point that may be the start of a low-level revolt, years-long uprising, insurgency?
Well, I'm not particularly. You'll remember the DMR essay I posted on this. I stand by that. Insofar as there won't be a civil war, however, I've always said you can expect low-level violence, and so long as all of these folks are being pushed by senior leaders and all of these weird conspiracy theories. If you want to call it an insurgency, I think the best definition is insurrectionists. This is the absolute dictionary definition of insurrection. But you're not going to have a serious insurgency. As I said in my article, most of these folks are in much greater need of cardio than tactical weapons. And as you saw, three out of the five folks that died during the sacking of the Capitol killed over from heart attacks. Mm-hmm. So, no, of course, I'm concerned even about low-level violence, but again, I would not get too wound up. You really have to keep your eye on the ball here, and I can assure you that our federal law enforcement agencies are perfectly able and now motivated highly to track and study these folks. It's all about resource allocation, and unfortunately, as these tides shift, you have to reallocate resources all the time, right? And so right. Now we're going to have to allocate more resources to worrying about these sorts of domestic insurgent groups. I think my prediction or analysis or assessment would be that you'll see something like a return to the 90s under the Clinton administration, where you had these armed militias here and there. If you remember David Koresh and Waco or Ruby Ridge, you'll see those sorts of things, these armed resistance groups that then force, you know, the ATF or some federal agency to respond, and then there's a cycle of anti-government rhetoric. That is what I would consider probable.
Okay. Evan Renfro, we'll talk in the coming months as we watch this develop, hopefully in a better direction. Evan Renfro, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Evan, thank you for joining us these few minutes.
You bet. Appreciate it, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. NASA's Juno spacecraft was launched back in 2011, 10 years ago, on board an instrument designed and built at the University of Iowa. Now, that spacecraft arrived at the planet Jupiter in the summer of 2016, was originally to have completed its mission to our solar system's largest planet and its moons this coming July in 2021. But last week, NASA announced it will extend the Juno mission through September of 2025, or until the spacecraft's end of life. And so the University of Iowa will have several more years to study Jupiter and its moons. Bill Kurth is with us. He's a research scientist at the University of Iowa Department of Physics and Astronomy, also lead investigator of what's called the WAVES instrument aboard the Juno spacecraft. Welcome back to our program, Bill.
Oh, thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
You have to be overjoyed with this announcement of this extension. I imagine you've known about it for longer than we have. What does this mean for the University of Iowa's instrument and your studies?
Well, we've had a great mission so far. We've made a number of discoveries and advances, and along the way, we've uncovered additional mysteries and questions that we'd like to ask and answer. And so we're very excited about having additional time to study the data that's coming back from Juno to try and understand how Jupiter works and how it interacts with its moons and magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm. So the WAVES instrument is, as far as you know, you're getting data from it. It's functioning perfectly, sending back data as it was designed to, still.
Yes. Yes. In fact, the entire spacecraft and other instruments seem to be in splendid health. So it's terrific that we get to continue to operate this beautiful spacecraft and to continue our studies.
This is a radio and plasma wave instrument. I know we can get really technical and above most of our heads here, but tell us what it measures and what's the significance, the most significant things it's discovered so far.
Well, it's a radio, and its frequency range extends from kind of the bottom of the audio frequency range, about 50 hertz, and it extends all the way up to about 40 megahertz. And it's designed to study naturally occurring waves in space plasmas. Plasmas are a gas, very hot gas, with charged particles, electrons, and ions. And when these move around, they cause waves, electric and magnetic fields. At the high frequency end, Jupiter is an extremely bright radio source. In fact, it's the brightest radio source in the solar system outside of possibly the sun. It generates radio emissions along with the process that creates the auroras, the northern and southern lights on Jupiter, similar to those at Earth. Those are the brightest auroras in the solar system. Everything about Jupiter is superlative, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we've done with the Juno instrument is that we've actually flown directly through the source of these very intense radio emissions. We had some ideas based on similar emissions at Earth, what we might find there, and we suspected that we knew the mechanism that generates these. In fact, we have flown through the sources, and we've confirmed that the generation mechanism that is operative at Earth also works at Jupiter, but generating much more intense radio emissions.
Mm-hmm. Bill, with all the problems we have currently on our planet, Earth, why is it important to understand, make new discoveries about these other planets?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have a colleague going back many, many years from Israel who worked on both Voyager and Galileo observations at Jupiter. And he was asked once why, coming from a country that's surrounded on all sides by enemies, his country pays him to study Jupiter. And his answer was very simple. He said, our government believes that if you don't have the arts and sciences, then you have nothing to defend. So I think it's the responsibility of scientists and artists in the world, including here in the United States, to extend our knowledge of the universe, to extend our appreciation of the beauty of it. And particularly for science, it's the generation of new knowledge and helping us understand what our place in the universe is, mm-hmm. and the nature of the universe itself.
We have just about 2 minutes left. Bill, you mentioned unanswered questions, mysteries about Jupiter. What do you put at the top of your list when you consider those mysteries about this mammoth planet?
Oh, it's hard to come down to one, but let me talk about lightning on Jupiter. We actually discovered lightning with our instrument on Voyager 1 way back in 1979 by hearing some radio emissions that we call lightning whistlers. These are short whistling tones that are generated by the discharge of lightning strokes in the atmosphere. And we've been studying those with the Juno instrument. And whereas at Earth, we all expect that the tropics and lower latitudes are the location where you find the most thunderstorms and therefore the most lightning, it turns out on Jupiter that most of the lightning occurs at mid to high latitudes. And so it's telling us something about Jupiter's atmosphere that we don't yet understand.
So it's in the what we would say the polar regions of Jupiter rather than the midsection.
Yes.
Wow.
And the other thing about lightning is it's telling us about the amount of water in the atmosphere. This is something that we don't fully understand, but the fact that we have convective storms that generate lightning suggests that there are water clouds, and this will give us a handle on how much water there is in the atmosphere.
Okay, Bill, we've run out of time. We'll look forward to talking with you further about the Juno mission, the Juno spacecraft launched way back in 2011. Bill Kurth is the lead investigator for the WAVES instrument aboard that Juno spacecraft near Jupiter. And he's a research scientist at the University of Iowa Department of Physics and Astronomy. Nice to touch bases with you, Bill, and congratulations on that extension of the mission to September 2025 at least.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Coming up after a short break, I'll talk with Marissa King, a sociologist from Yale. Her new book is Social Chemistry, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.